the order in which I plan to do things yesterday, just to ensure that I get certain things covered. So what I'm going to do at the beginning today is jump right into inflation. And I'm going to just give a kind of summary of inflation, to make the main points, give an example of a model, describe some things about inflation. And then when I'm done with that, I'm going to go back and start to talk a little bit about the thermal history of the universe. And in particular, I'm going to try to focus on the production of thermal relics in the universe. And by thermal relics here, I mean anything from, you know, topological defects to dark matter particles, anything like that. And I'm going to try to set that up with a view to the fact that Henry may talk about, for example, brain inflation and superstring cosmic string. So I want to try to leave him in a good place for that. Most of what I'm saying here, in fact, much more than what I'm saying in these 2.5 hours, are contained in a set of Tassie lectures that I gave 2 years ago, which are published on the web. And I'll ask Rob to put a link on the homepage to those lectures. So if you want a set of notes that include what I've said here, plus some more things, it's there. And in particular, if you want a better set of notes, a more complete set of notes on inflation, I advise you to look at the excellent textbook by Little and Life. So maybe I'll happily write that up at the end if people remind me. OK, so I'm going to start today at with the problems of the standard cosmology. And in a couple of places, I'm going to make reference to the microwave background. You've all heard of the microwave background. You kind of know what it is, although I haven't talked about it in any detail. Hopefully, I'll get to that on my way back in the second half of today's lecture. So yesterday, somebody asked me, actually, you know, can I, when I was talking about the spatial curvature of the universe, you know, can you make a transition from k equals 1 to k equals minus 1, et cetera, et cetera. I told them no. But I didn't actually write down any equations. But actually, what I'm going to say at the beginning of today should answer that question, as well as put me where I want to be. So what I want to talk about is problems of the standard cosmology. Standard cosmology is just, it does not include inflation. And I say that, you might think the standard cosmology should include inflation these days. It gives us a lot of things we want. But I'm going to reserve the phrase standard cosmology to mean things which have undergone multiple tests with data. And inflation really has not, I would say. It's a fantastic idea. And it certainly is our only way of understanding certain things right now. But nevertheless, I wouldn't say it's a very well-tested idea. So I'm going to put that outside the standard cosmology. So I want to rewrite the Friedman equation that I wrote last time. So remind you what that is first in the form that I wrote it yesterday. The Friedman equation was this. And I want to rewrite that by dividing through by h squared and write it as where omega here means omega total. So I divided through by h squared, and I've used the fact that 8 pi g over 3 h squared is 1 over the critical density. And so that's why that became omega. And I've written it this way. Okay, so this is just the Friedman equation. Omega is omega total, as I said. And now I want to differentiate this equation with respect to the scale factor. So I'm going to do d by dA. And a little bit of algebra, really a very small amount of algebra, involves you using the second Einstein equation as well. But you can do that. Will yield the following equation. So use second Einstein equation. We'll give you the omega by dA is equal to 1 plus 3w omega, omega minus 1 over A. And I've, of course, used here that the universe is dominated by something which satisfies d equals w rho. You could solve this equation. It's an easy equation to solve. But I'm not going to bother because it has pretty much all the information I want to use right there. So let me plot here what features of this equation are. And it's should be fairly clear to you that this equation has fixed points at omega equals 0 and omega equals 1. Also has a fixed point at omega equals infinity. So now suppose that the universe, or in the standard cosmology, all I told you about in the universe were things like baryons, photons. And so, in particular, things we talked about were dust, which had W equals 0, and radiation, which had W equals 1/3. Both these forms for matter satisfy 1 plus 3W is greater than 0. So the right-hand side of this, so now just want to point out something rather simple. If you started with omega less than 1, which I remind you corresponds to having spatial sections that are open, k equals minus 1, then omega is between 0 and 1. This is positive, this is negative, this is positive, this is positive. This whole right-hand side is negative, and you'll be driven away from omega equals 1. And by a similar argument, if you start out just with density just a little greater than 1, then every term on the right-hand side is positive, and you'll be driven, again, away from omega equals 1. So omega equals 1 is a repeller of this equation. And so all trajectories go away from it and head off, and this lower part head off to 0 of the equation. So the answer to yesterday's question, this is why you never cross the omega equals 1 barrier. But the point, the more interesting point to point out about this equation is that this creates a huge problem for the standard cosmology. Because remember what I told you yesterday, and I gave you this accounting of the energy budget of the universe, and it contains matter, the matter that you're made of at the level of 5%, dark matter at the level of 25%, and dark energy at the level of 75%. But you can forget the dark energy for the purposes of this. In fact, you could even forget the dark matter if you only want to believe what you see with your own eyes. The fact that your omega is 0.05 in baryons alone is a complete disaster from the point of view of this plot. Because wherever you'd like to think, wherever you start the universe, it should end up with some matter in it that looks something like just today. But the problem is that it does not. So you can ask the question, in order to have just the matter we see in the universe, forget, you know, what W map tells you omega total is or anything like that, just the matter in the universe, what you need. So to have omega not be approximately 0 today, what do you need? And what you need is to have something like this. Okay? These numbers can be moved around by deciding exactly how much matter you're prepared to put up within the universe. But I think we'd agree that this is a ridiculously small number. So that says that wherever the universe started, if the standard cosmology is right, and we're to have a universe today that has stuff in it, you, then you must have started the universe with extremely special initial conditions. Even though I'm allowing for universes, for cosmological spacetimes, and the symmetries we know allow for cosmological spacetimes with k equals 1, k equals minus 1, k equals 0, nevertheless, you must have started in a universe that was so absurdly close to omega equals 1 that it was essentially completely spatially flat, that you are essentially in a k equals 0 universe. And that's an extremely high degree of fine-tuning, and within the standard cosmology, there's no explanation of this. Okay. So this problem, this fine-tuning problem, gets a name, and it's called the flatness problem. Why did the universe begin so incredibly close to spatial flatness? Okay. Okay, so I'm going to come back to that in a moment. But now I just want to leave this as a problem. And I want to move on to something called the horizon problem. Now, last time I told you about horizons, including cosmological spacetimes. I talked about the particle horizon. I also talked about the event horizon associated with cosmologies. And basically, certainly the particle horizon occurs because there's only been a finite amount of time from the Big Bang for light to travel. It's not a particularly deep concept. It's just that from the Big Bang onwards, there's only so much time for photons to reach you, so there'll always be regions of space from which photons are still on their way to you. The very first photons are on their way to you. Now, in order to talk about the horizon problem, I need to talk about the CMB, and I'm not going to talk about it in detail here except to remind you that you all have heard about the CMB, and it's a bath of photons that was released from the universe when the universe was about 300,000 years old. And I'll come back later in today's talk and give you details about that, but all you need to know for now is that. So, I want to think about light propagating in the universe with horizons. So, consider a photon. This is like last time, along a radial trajectory. So, ignore theta and phi. And I'm going to, for simplicity, set k equals 0, although this can all be redone in more gory detail with k not equal to 0. I'm going to only, okay? And this is traveling towards it. And because k equals 0, you recall I said last time, I'm free to set the scale factor today to be 1. So I'll do that. Okay. So this is a radial null path, like last time. And it obeys 0 is the s squared is minus dt squared plus a squared of t dr squared. Where because it's radial, I've ignored the theta and phi components, and because it's flat, I have no k there in the r squared part. Therefore, the co-moving, so co-moving, of course, meaning coordinate, you know, in these coordinates, not taking into account the scale factor, the co-moving distance traveled by this photon, between times t1 and t2 is, so up here, delta r, so it's the change in coordinates, it's the coordinate distance, is the integral from t1 to t2, dt over a of t. Just by integrating this. Okay. Now, if you want to get the physical distance, you just multiply this by the scale factor. So. Just multiply by it. So now let's specialize to the case of a particular universe. So let's assume that we're matter-dominated. Just to give us a concrete example to focus on. So in matter-domination, we discovered last time that the scale factor evolves in the following way. Last time I had an A0 in there, but since I'm setting A0 to be 1, this is the form that matters. So what's the Hubble parameter? The Hubble parameter, which is A dot over A, is 2/3 T inverse. And you can see, just using this, that is the same as A to the minus 3 over 2 times H0. So just do h by h0 and you'll get that. Everyone's okay with that? So now let's go back to this co-moving distance that the photon travels. So delta r, you can just do that integral now. And the distance is 2 h0 inverse square root of a2 minus the square root of a1. Where A i is A at T i. Okay. Yes. Teacher. Sorry. Yes, teacher. So now, where was I? Oh, good. Right. So this is a general statement. Okay. This is just a general statement about radial null rays traveling in this universe. So now I want to think about a particular radial null ray. I want to think about the size of the co-moving horizon. Okay. So I want to think about where, what is the horizon size, and let's see. Oh, maybe I'll use this board up here. So the horizon size, the co-moving horizon size, well, that, of course, is a special case. It corresponds to, at any time t, corresponds to A1, or T1, at which the photon was released, being essentially the Big Bang. And so I can set A1 to 0. So therefore, I get that R horizon at some, so at some time t star, so just some random time t star, will then be equal to, well, it's 2H0 inverse times the square root of A star, and A1 is 0, so I don't need it. Okay? So this is the coordinate distance that a photon can travel since the Big Bang. Okay? It's the size of the, and anything, any distance larger than this is a distance beyond which, in the standard cosmology, you would not have been able to see since the Big Bang. So you would know no information outside that distance. Is that clear to everyone? If it's not, please tell me now. Okay. So what's the physical horizon size? So, and this comes back to your question a moment ago. So D horizon, the actual physical size at A star, is A star, this is why I said it was 2 that you multiplied by, R horizon at A star. And that is nothing but 2H0 inverse A star to the 3 over 2, but A star to the 3 over 2 H0 inverse is just 1 over H, and so this is just 2 H star inverse. Okay? So that's the physical size of the horizon at time T star. And actually, this is a generic result, so I'll just give an aside here. So in any almost flat cosmology, with just radiation and matter, then dH is always of order H inverse. Yes. Let me see if I can get better. Is that better? Okay. Everyone else can see that okay? Here? Here? Could you speak up? Oh, thank you. There. Yes. Okay. So just a kind of notational aside is that people, because of this, H inverse is the thing that I call the Hubble distance. Okay? H inverse is the Hubble distance. Let me say this here. And oftentimes, cosmologists and other people will interchangeably use the phrases Hubble distance and horizon distance, and the reason they do that is precisely this statement I made over here. And the reason you want to avoid doing that is that when I start to talk about inflation, which doesn't just involve radiation and matter, these two things can be drastically different. And in fact, the source of what is so powerful about inflation is the fact that these two become extremely decoupled in the context of inflation. So it's important to keep the distinction straight. So what is the horizon problem? All I've done so far is tell you how big the horizon is. And the horizon problem is the statement It's a statement about the microwave background radiation. It goes like this. So the microwave background radiation was released from the photon baryon plasma when the universe was 300,000 years old. And as I said, I'll have to come back and show you details about that. So the CMB is released, if you like, only exists at A CMB is about 1 over 1200, where I'm using A today to be 1. Okay? But that's a problem because the co-moving distance between the CMB and ours, meaning observers on Earth today, is delta R is 2H0 inverse 1 minus square root of ACMB by this formula over here. But of course, this is just irrelevant, 1 over square root of 1200 compared to 1, so this is very much approximately 2H0 inverse. While the co-moving distance between different points on the sky, well, co-moving distance, sorry. Say it this way, co-moving horizon distance, sorry about that writing, at t times TCMB is just r horizon at ACMB, which is about, which is, well, 2H0 inverse square root of ACMB, which is approximately, well, it's 6 times 10 to the minus 2 H0 inverse. So let me try to draw on a sketch what this tells you. The problem with horizons is that they limit the extent to which information can propagate between different points in space-time. And here what they're doing is the following. So let me draw a kind of space-time diagram. Sketch of one. So here's time, and here's space. And you can think about this bottom line as being, you know, very, very close to the Big Bang singularity. But what's most important is that it's significantly before the CMB is released. Here's the time at which the CMB is released. Here is today, us today, and here's our past horizon. And now look out on the sky in two different directions, say over here and over here, and ask, you know, what sets of events could have influenced that point? And of course, that's given by this. And now you'll see a problem. Is this, if this diagram's not clear to you, please tell me now if you can use it. Okay. So now you see the problem. We look out on the CMB sky, and you've all seen these pictures from COBE and later from WMAP, and you look over here, and the temperature of the microwave background radiation is 2.78 degrees. The temperature over here is 2.78 degrees, to 1 part in 10 to the 5, and it's true of all parts on the sky. But most dramatically in this diagram, the points over there on the sky and the points over there on the sky were never, ever in causal contact with one another in the entire history of the standard cosmology. So if the standard cosmology is all there is to it, this is another problem. We had the flatness problem, which was a fine-tuning problem. This is also, you could think of this as a fine-tuning problem, but it's worse than that. It really is a challenge to our notions of cosmic history. So this actually, this is the most extreme thing I'm showing you here, because I'm plotting in just in one spatial dimension. So I'm saying, look over here, the temperatures are the same. Isn't that ridiculous? Eventually, if you look at any 2 points on the sky that are separated by more than a few degrees, those points have never in the entire history of the, if you're looking at the CMB, I should say, those points have never in the entire history of the universe, if the standard cosmology is correct, been in causal contact. And yet they shine with a microwave background light that is the same temperature to 1 part in 10 to the 5. And that's ridiculous. So this is called the horizon problem, sometimes called the homogeneity problem. And it's really why is the CMB the same temperature in all directions, well, in directions that have never been in causal contact. Now, there are other problems with the standard cosmology. Yes? No, it's more... It's not a good analogy, and the reason is this. The point there is that no one is disputing here, by the way, that the physical processes that give rise to temperature are any different in these different parts of the space. The point is that you have no, what do we see when we look out in the universe? We see an incredibly homogeneous universe. Okay. If the universe from the very beginning truly was absolutely homogeneous and all physical processes what took place in the same way at the same times, then indeed we would have no problem with the fact that the temperature is the same in different places. But the reality is that there is no reason to assume that at all. And in fact, you would expect that in the far past, from the beginning, the universe begins back here. We don't understand how it begins, but I could say all kind of words about, well, there'll be huge quantum fluctuations in all kinds of fields back then, and in some places there'll be large fluctuations and other small fluctuations, et cetera, et cetera. And there's no good reason back here to have such an incredibly homogeneous universe. And so there's no reason to prepare your pan of water in exactly the same state in two different parts of the universe. You can think of it as a fine-tuning problem. That's right. So that's what I said a moment ago. It is a form of fine-tuning. It says, why do we begin the universe in such an incredibly homogeneous state? Right. Yeah, that's right. Let me go here and I'll come back to that. So actually, this is really a definition of what you mean by cosmic time. So the CMB is released, the time at which the CMB is released, if you like, that slicing of the universe in which the CMB is homogeneous is the slicing that defines how cosmic time goes forward, because that defines what it means to have homogeneous spatial hypersurfaces. So we know that's possible within, I wrote down the metric that was homogeneous and isotropic, but you could ask the legitimate question, well, you know, what do I slice it that way, okay? I mean, if I have, it's kind of a awkward analogy, but if I have a bunch of objects that are homogeneously spaced, and at a later time they're still homogeneous, but more spread out, Now, that's a homogeneous isotropic description of a set of objects, but I could slice it that way. If I did that, it would no longer have homogeneous hypersurfaces. And the slicing which we choose when I write down that initial metric is the slicing in which the CMBs are based on a homogeneous hypersurface. That defines quantum time. Okay. There was a question here. No, the singularity is not part of the Big Bang. Okay? So the Big Bang really refers to the fact that the universe was in a very small, very hot, very dense state early on. No, it's not. The universe could easily be infinite. It wouldn't all be in contact at all. So the universe, it's not that it's, I don't know that you're doing this, but I'm suggesting that you might be thinking of it as being a little plank-sized ball, the entire universe, and therefore it's all in contact, and then it expands. And that's really not the way it is. The point is that the entire universe comes into existence at what we call the Big Bang. So it could be infinite. Okay, in that case, you know, there are points in the universe that start sending off signals to one another at that precise time and never have an opportunity for those signals to meet to reach the other point in the entire history of the universe from then on. And that's the point of horizons. Okay. Now, your question, I mean, I don't know that you're asking this question, but a related question could be, well, could there be some mechanism, whatever, you know, brings the universe into existence at the beginning, could that set very special initial conditions without the need for some subsequent dynamics to set? And that's a question for quantum gravity, and since we don't have a, maybe I shouldn't say in this audience, since we don't have a theory of quantum gravity that has yet addressed this question, I don't know how to answer it. But I will get to inflation as a way to alleviate some of these problems. Yeah. But the singularity does not help you there. Yeah. So, I mean, absolutely. So I'm addressed, that's right, that's right. So I'm certainly, everything I'm writing here is in the context of the standard cosmology with perfect fluid radiation and matter sources. So in that case, I've built in this, the Copernican principle, and it's whatever I say about my place is the same is true at any other place. Okay, now, if you're asking, I'm not quite sure what direction to take your question, but, certainly, this is all cosmology is to do with what we see. That's it. So all I care about here is what we see. Right? There is no cosmology about things that we don't observe yet. There's hypothesis, and there's speculation, and there's things you can say about, well, you know, things are coming inside our horizon all the time, but we see what we see, and that's it. That is the universe to us. So I'm definitely restricting it just to what we see. But the microwave background, we do see, and so it's... and you know, so here I followed the equations I wrote down last time for universe dominated by matter and radiation to the logical conclusion, going backwards in time, and that alone gives you this conclusion that these points never in the entire history of the evolution were in contact. And it doesn't take me outside I'm not talking about anything which we don't observe. Someone else had a hand up? I'm not sure. Yeah. Yes, that's where I'm going. I think we're saying the same thing. I'm going to talk about inflation. Is that not what you meant? Say that again. Oh, okay, good. No, I mean, you're quite right. Exactly what I'm going to do is introduce a new type of matter which will help us to address this problem. So it's exactly right. More questions? Okay. So this is the horizon problem. I told you about the horizon and flatness problem. There are some other problems with the standard cosmology, which I'm not sure I'll get to today, but Henry's going to talk about some related things, I think. One thing is the existence of topological defects. You know, we know that the standard model of particle physics is SU2 cross U1, and if you think there's a grand unified theory out there that puts those groups, including along with QCD, into a simple group, and that group breaks to the standard model, it turns out you will inevitably produce what I call monopoles, and those monopoles will dominate the evolution of the universe and ruin cosmic evolution. And so I mentioned that as a real possibility, but Also something which is something of an aside, because if the universe never is hot enough to hit the gut area, you just won't care about it. But these problems will exist anyway. But the point here is that there are a lot of issues that one needs to deal with at early times in the standard cosmology, which are not addressed within the standard cosmology. So I'd like to just restrict for now to the flatness and horizon problems. Okay. So. Now, the horizon problem is a particularly difficult problem to solve because it's really, at its heart, causality. That's all that I've really invoked here. And if you want to get around it, you're going to have to find a way to put these points in touch with one another at early times. And the only way to do that is to go outside of what I've talked about, which is the standard cosmology with radiation and say, regular matter sources. It turns out the way to do this, and I'm going to show you why that's so, but I'm going to just advertise up front, the way to do this is to, so these can both be solved or, let's say, addressed if there is a period of cosmic, and that means a long enough period, of cosmic evolution, and I'll show you why this is so, with A double dot positive. And in fact, I'll just say A double dot over A because it'll enable me to write some further equations simpler. Well, let me talk a little bit about the kind of matter sources I want to use and then show you why this helps. And this is going to be exactly what you suggested a moment ago. So I'm going to go on to a particle physicist and a cosmologist's favorite friend, scalar fields, and I want to talk about slowly rolling scalar fields. And so last time I wrote down what the Einstein equations are for cosmology. On the right-hand side of the Einstein equations goes the energy-momentum tensor for matter. And for a scalar field, the energy-momentum tensor, so a field phi, I just want to think about a singlet scalar field phi with a potential V of phi. And the energy-momentum tensor then takes the form that. Okay, so some kinetic terms, some gradient terms, and some potential terms. Okay. Now, for simplicity, I'm going to set k equals 0. Everything I'm doing here can easily be redone with k not equal to 0. It's just that things are messier, and I don't want to go into that because I don't have much time. And assume homogeneity. So really, I'm asking, what is the dynamics of a universe, of a cosmological space-time, whose matter, energy, momentum source is a homogeneous scalar field with a potential? So then a homogeneous scalar field behaves as a perfect fluid with the following definitions. The energy density in phi is 1/2 phi dot squared plus V of phi, so kinetic energy plus potential energy. And the pressure in phi is 1/2 phi dot squared minus V of phi. What should be clear to you is that this certainly does not obey the simple form that the perfect fluids I've been using so far obey. Namely, P is not simply related to rho. There is no equation of state parameter that is constant for the entire evolution of something like this, at least not in general. Now, the scalar field has the equation of motion that I'll write over here. So you can get this equation of motion any way you like. You can do del mu t mu nu. You can use that perfect fluid equation I wrote down last time and use that rho and that p. But the answer you will get in all cases is phi double dot plus 3h, which I will choose to write as a dot by a, phi dot plus dv by d is 0. So this is just the usual equation of motion for a scalar field in Minkowski space with a term that comes from the fact that you're not in Minkowski space, and you can interpret this term as being friction due to the expansion of the universe. It's a term that depends on phi dot, the velocity of the field, and has a, and the coefficient of this term, the term that governs how much the friction is, depends on the Hubble parameter at that time, a dot over a. Okay, so it's quite a simple equation. And the Friedmann equation is h squared is 8 pi g over 3 times rho. And since I'm setting k equals 0, that's all we have. Okay. So how might we get, for help, I'm going to write down the acceleration equation. So you'll remember I mentioned something called the acceleration equation last time, said I would use it only in a couple of places, and this is one of those places. You get this from combining the first and second Einstein equations, and it says rho and p are over there. So how might you get this accelerated expansion? Okay. So to get that accelerated expansion, you need rho plus 3p to be negative. In other words, so p is less than minus 1. Rho, certainly that's not satisfied by dust and it's not satisfied by radiation, but it could easily be satisfied by a scalar field. And one easy way to satisfy this, not the only way, but certainly, but the easy way for a scalar field to satisfy this is if its kinetic energy, phi dot squared, half phi dot squared, is much, much less than its potential energy. And this is what I meant over here when I started talking about slowly rolling. Yes? Why the pressure is the Lagrangian? I don't know if there's a physical reason I can give you. I don't know if anyone else has a comment on that. I mean, certainly you can just see it from here if you write this out and compare it with the perfect fluid form I wrote down before. I don't have a deep answer to that question. If anyone else wants to shout up, please do. Sure. But then, well, right. But even so, I guess I don't have a physical answer. So if the field is rolling slowly, and by that I mean its kinetic energy is much less than its potential energy, obviously this term can be neglected in both these expressions. So in that case, p is approximately minus rho, because you can just see that from over there. And this is, you know, and you can compare this to a cosmological constant. It behaves the same way. In fact, it's a contribution to the cosmological constant. And if that happens, then the universe will indeed accelerate. So I want to tell you some details about how that acceleration happens and what. So this acceleration is what we call inflation. Before I do that, I should convince you that it matters. So let me just take a step back and remind you what the flatness problem was. I'll talk about the horizon problem in a moment, but let me show you rather obviously why the flatness problem cares about something like this. You'll remember the flatness problem I illustrated by writing down the following equation. And I showed you the fixed points of this equation. And now you can see what happens. If you have a type of matter that causes the universe to accelerate, in other words, p is less than minus 1/3 rho, that means that 1 plus 3w is negative. So less than 0 if p is less than minus 1/3 rho, which is the same as a double dot of rho, positive. And that just flips the sign on the right-hand side of this equation, and everything I said to you about the nature of the fixed points of this equation gets flipped. So omega equals 1, instead of being a repeller of this equation, becomes an attractor. And omega equals 0, instead of being an attractor, becomes a repeller. So if you start off anywhere out here at early times, then what will happen is you will be driven towards 1. And if inflation, this period of accelerated expansion, lasts long enough, you will become so fantastically close to 1, and by that I mean closer than (10⁻⁶), that when this accelerated expansion ends, in the entire history of the universe, from the end of inflation onwards, and we'll see that goes from, you know, the Planck time to today, that cosmic evolution which reversed the nature of these attractors, so this is inflation. Inflation ends somewhere, say here. And thereafter, this becomes a repeller again. The universe is dominated by regular radiation of matter. This is now a repeller. But in the entire history of cosmic evolution, you've got so close in this time period that you've never, ever had time to significantly get away from zero. And so, for the flatness problem at least, this is a very attractive solution. It's a dynamical mechanism that drives an extremely wide range of initial conditions to omega equals 1. And it does, and if inflation lasts long enough, then even today, we would not have time for the universe to have deviated from omega equals 1 sufficiently to notice it. And so, this is a rather elegant way of explaining why the universe is spatially flat today, given a wide range of initial conditions. Okay. Now, I haven't told you anything about this scalar field phi yet. It's just an idea, but this is the general way in which inflation solves a flatness problem. So let me go back to the scalar field phi now and talk a little bit about what it does. Actually, can somebody give me the time check? What time did I start? 45. Okay. So now, let me be more technical about the slow roll approximation. So the slow roll approximation means neglect phi double dot in that equation. And so if you do that, you will find that that means that phi dot is approximately minus v prime. By prime here, I mean dv by d phi, minus v prime over 3h. And then if you go back to the Friedmann equation, you can then write that h squared is approximately 8 pi g over 3 v of phi, because the kinetic energy part is negligible. So when do these hold? If you go to any cosmology textbook, any paper on inflation, they will refer to a couple of parameters that describe, that are sufficient conditions for this to hold. So sufficient conditions for this. Are epsilon and eta much less than 1, where slow roll parameters. Are epsilon, which is defined to be m Planck squared over 2 v prime by v squared, and eta defined to be m Planck squared v double prime by v. So if you have a potential and these two conditions are satisfied somewhere on the potential, and your field is evolving at that point on the potential with those satisfied, then that will be sufficient for a cosmology driven by that scalar field to start accelerating and inflating. Okay. There's nothing deep about writing these down, by the way. These are just useful because these actually are the parameters that enter several observational consequences of inflation, so they're useful things to have. I'm not going to show that those are sufficient conditions. It's a simple thing to show. It's useful to have a general expression for how much inflation takes place. And the general expression for how much inflation takes place is given by the following. It just says, we call this the number of e-foldings. So the number of e-foldings and it's defined by the number of e-foldings at a time t is just the logarithm of the scale factor when inflation ends divided by the scale factor when inflation begins. And I'm defining a at t end by epsilon at phi end equals 1. So when epsilon becomes 1, the slow roll conditions are violated, inflation ends, and that tells you how many e-folds you've had up to that point. I can write this as, yes, and how much, so the universe is accelerating here. So it's expanding, I should have said that in a little more detail. So it's expanding essentially exponential because of this. So if you were to put w equals minus 1, in the Friedman equation for perfect fluid, you'd see that it's accelerating, it's going exponentially. So inflation, of course, does not require it to be really exponential. All it requires is this. So this gives us a general expression, which really will be the number of e-foldings if it's exponentially expanding, but will be something we call the number of e-foldings. But will just give you a measure of how much expansion is taking place. Thank you. And this can be written as, I'm not going to bother proving this. You can prove this just using the Friedman equation. Like that, in terms of the potential. Okay. They're not necessary, but they're sufficient. That's right. But, well, okay, I'm going to postpone an answer to that question. So you're quite right, but typically when, in most models of inflation, if you violate epsilon being 1, you'll also kill e to the n 1. So the models of inflation that allow you to still inflate, violate these, typically still have epsilon small, but violate the eta condition. So that's why I'm using epsilon to signal the end of inflation. It's a safe way to do it. So these are slow roll, I define kind of loosely here to mean, well, the kinetic energy is small, so it's slowly rolling down a potential. And this, these, so these are the parameters that if these parameters satisfy this, you're guaranteed that that will be the case. So these are the parameters that tell you whether you're slowly rolling or not. They're sufficient to tell you you're slowly rolling. Okay, so in the last probably 5 minutes or something, let me write down what happens. Let's see how far I get. I'm going to write down some solutions for a very, very simple model and try to just show you how the horizon problem is solved, and if I don't get far enough, I don't get far enough. So let me go here. So simple model, just to get the picture of what's going on. And this is chaotic inflation with a particular potential. Turn you to Linde. You might think that since you need things to slowly roll, that your potential needs to be ridiculously flat, and that is true. But you might think that you might think that involves some exotic form for the potential. But actually, usually for a general low potential, it just requires that you be far enough up on the potential. It's not always true. There are certain exponential potentials for which it's not true. But just as an example, let me show you the following. Let's just consider the following, just the mass term. And I'll assume that inflation begins at the end of the quantum epoch. At t equals zero, rho is about m Planck to the fourth. So you emerge from some quantum epoch. The energy density is typically Planck to the fourth. And I'm going to call that time t equals zero. I can label time any way I like. And I'm going to go through this quite quickly just to try to get to my punchline. By demanding that this equals this, since I want slow roll conditions to be true, so slow roll, so saying v equals this, implies that phi, at the beginning of inflation, phi zero, is m Planck squared over m, which I will write as m Planck, and this is unfortunate notation, so I apologize, over epsilon, curly epsilon. And epsilon will be much less than 1. I will choose m to be so that epsilon is less than 1. So epsilon, I should say, is a m over m. Planck. Okay, so then h, using the Friedman equation, is simply seen to be alpha phi, where alpha is defined to be root 4 pi by 3, curly epsilon. Kind of a handy notation. And these equations are actually, so the scalar field equation is phi double dot plus 3 alpha phi from the H term, phi dot plus m squared phi is 0. And this has an easy solution. Phi is phi 0 minus beta t, where beta is just m squared over 3 alpha. Okay. Slow roll is okay in this potential. It works if phi is bigger than beta over m, which is m Planck squared, m Planck over root 12 pi. And in a random old potential that you write down, something like this is always true. If you take the field off to values bigger than the Planck mass, typically you get to a region where you're inflating. And you can see that just from looking at this chart. Okay. How am I doing here for time? Am I at 45 now? Okay. Problem. Okay, that'll be great. I just want to, it might not even take that long. Okay. So how long is that solution valid? That solution I wrote down there for phi, the exact solution, is valid for a time, delta t, which goes like phi 0 over m over beta, sorry, which is about the Planck time over epsilon squared. Okay, so at that point, the slow roll approximations I've made will break down. I can no longer use them and get this nice approximate solution. Okay, so I'm aware that I'm rushing a little bit through this, but hopefully you just get the gist. There's a potential. In the slow roll approximation, I can actually solve everything. I can tell you how the scalar field evolves, and I can tell you how the scale factor evolves. And this is interesting, among other things, because this is actually an attractor solution. So this is also an attractor solution. And I won't prove that because I don't have time. Okay. So if you start off up there in this potential, you approach the solution automatically, and you get inflation. So that's nice. So in the extra couple of minutes that Rob granted me, let me just now finally, having shown you that this kind of accelerated expansion can explain the flatness problem, let me show you that it also explains the horizon problem. So the scale factor obeys this equation. A of t is a zero exponential, or as I advertised a moment ago, 2 pi over m Planck squared, phi zero squared minus phi squared. Okay, so it exponentially increases. And inflation lasts, so inflation ends at t equals delta t, and a at delta t is a zero exponential 2 pi over epsilon squared. See that from here. And so let's take a typical value for m. So choose m. Well, we have to choose m so that this curly epsilon is much less than 1. So I'll just choose m to be, just to give me epsilon is less than 10 to the minus 4, let's say, some small number, which means that everything I did here is definitely under control. In that case, a at delta t is about a at the beginning times 10 to the 2.7 times 10 to the 8. And this is quite dramatic, because in a time that is large compared to the Planck time, but not hugely large compared to the Planck time, the universe, the scale factor increased by 10 to the 10 to the 8. So that's dramatic by anyone's standards, I think. That makes the cosmological constant problem look like a walk in the park. Okay, what's 120 orders of magnitude when you've got 10 to the 10 to the 8 here from inflation? And what happens to this is that a proper distance size the Planck size at t equals 0 becomes 10 to the 10 to the 8 centimeters at delta t is about 10 to the minus 36 seconds. So how big is the universe today? By the universe today, I mean how big is our horizon today. So by comparison, the horizon today is 10 to the 28 centimeters. So a Planckian region is blown up by this expansion into something 10 to the 10 to the 8 centimeters in size over an absurdly short length of time. The observable universe today is only 10 to the 28 centimeters across. And this is where this distinction between the Hubble size and the horizon size becomes crucial. But it's true that the Hubble size is always H inverse. We know what that is today. But now you see what happened here. So let me draw one last picture to kind of finish with. What happened here is that the picture I drew before for the horizon problem, so I'm just going to be schematic here. The horizon problem went like this. There's when the CMB was released. There was the line I'm going to draw here, what I previously called the Big Bang. Here we are. Here's our back cone. Here's our initial problem. And the point is that there was some tiny patch in here at early times that expanded out to much, 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 much bigger than our current horizon size at early times. And so both these regions, and this point, if you like, came from an early region that was significantly smaller than the Planck size, and therefore seems eminently reasonable, should have had the right initial conditions, should have had the same initial conditions, and therefore ultimately yielded the same temperature of the CMB at later times. It's essentially my way of saying that that's the way your pans of water get prepared in the same state. Okay, there's a lot more to say about inflation, there's a lot more to say about cosmology. I can't do it in this amount of time, but hopefully Henry will tell you a lot more, and Lev will tell you even more. So thanks for listening.